Anniversary, make a note of that, Randy.
Your anniversary working?
You're ready, Brian.
Married. All right, good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kulk. It's approximately a little bit after 10 o'clock on June 26th. We're meeting today for a work session on case number PU 13-51, Tailright Corporation's request to be designated eligible carrier. We've had, I don't know if this is our second or third or fourth work session on this, but we're moving forward on it. I guess I'll turn it over to Commissioner Crisman as soon as I'm done here. But my understanding of the goal of the work session is that we've had some documents prepared by staff dealing with maybe a certification that the company may need to sign before we would approve it. And we've also got some legal review. Austin's got some background and some things. And so with that, I think I'll turn it over to Randy. Just kind of you've been really leading the charge in what we're doing now at this point, quite honestly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, a lot of my thoughts on it are generic to which companies we're dealing with. So even though this is a Tailright work session, my concerns and thoughts aren't so much specific to Tailright Company or their proposal, but to how we want the Lifeline-only ETC, the Lifeline-only cellular companies operating and licensed in North Dakota. So I see it now, but I have not read and absorbed this memorandum. So I'm kind of almost ignoring that at this point. And I'll make some comments, and then our legal people can tell me if I'm overstepping. Sarah and I have worked on some plans, or Sarah did all the work, but I just observed, of a certification process and some questions to be included with it. And do you have a copy of that?
I do, and I've read through it.
As I look at that, the certification part, the 18 items, I think we're very close to hitting the nail on the head. I do have a couple questions that I want to ask Sarah here, or, you know, for your comment. But on number 17, as I recall somewhere, and I don't know where it is, in the federal rules, when they're signing up customers, they get something to show that the customer qualifies, and then they have to either, there are some things they have to either return or destroy. So, but they can't save. And so do we need an exception for things that they're not able to keep? If the federal laws say that they have to return or destroy, like an identification card or something like that, and our rule says that they have to save it, I don't know if that's an issue. And then the other concern I had is on number 15, we probably should include the form number that Human Services likes, the 1059. And then just a question, I guess, for the commissioners, is annually, as this says, the right term, or would we want those quarterly or semi-annually or what? I'm fine with annually, but
well, I would, to be candid with you, I mean, I was ready to vote for this day one. So anything that above and beyond this, I would be fine semi-annually or annually, every 2 years. Because I think there's and we'll get to it after we go through this, but there's a real question, and that's the point of the memorandum that legal just produced, that there's a real question that what we can really actually do. And we'll get to that with the memo, I think, but that's where I think that this document that we're working on now, get it to where we're comfortable with it, but then there'll be a second question that may actually become more difficult to answer.
Okay, so then, as far as I'm concerned, annually is fine there. I do think we should add in the form number so that we're clear.
Sarah, I put form number in, but I asked her to take it out until we were sure. We do need that form for Human Services, but we might need something additional for the
Oh.
Like that's so Human Services can tell us stuff.
Okay.
But so that should, I didn't read it and I didn't bring it because I didn't print it, but that should be identified, but we weren't that far yet.
Okay. And then on 17, the first thing I mentioned there, do we need to put some kind of an exception in there for things that they're not allowed to keep? Other than that, I really like this certification form. And then my only other thing that I had on the questions, I don't know what you call this form, Sarah, the six questions. Mm-hmm. Do we need number 5 in there anymore, since it has to do with that release and it's included in number 15?
We could take it off, but I was making a presumption that they would get the questions. Oops, sorry, I'm not on the mic. We can take that off, but I was under the presumption that they would probably be asking these questions before they signed the certification. Oh. And so I had a little bit of a concern that if they didn't know what was coming in the certification and it was something they couldn't agree to, maybe we could, by asking the question, kind of make a they would make a determination then that they don't want to proceed with their application in the state.
Sounds like a good idea then.
We have to ask them at this point. I think the only thing that we can do is ask them to willingly agree to things that we want. And if they don't want to agree, that's a separate question that we would have to address if we go there. But I think we want to ask them first.
Yeah. Well, those things explain then. I'm pretty happy with this. But I guess we need to go through this memorandum then.
Well, but no, I guess what I'm hearing is that if we've got a company X, that it, well, in this case, Telluride, they'll talk to the point of the work session. What I'm hearing is that if whether they have to or not, that's a separate question. But if Telluride would sign the form as it is now with the small changes that were recommended, you would support authorizing Telluride's motion.
I would with. You know, when we have these six questions,
right?
You know, we ask for the reports to FCC and USAC, and whether they've had, you know, troubles in the past, and what assuming that there's not something in there that's dramatic, why
sure.
We would deny them.
Understood.
We don't want to ask for it and not care what's in it.
Sure, good
but
point.
But assuming that everything is kosher in those questions. Yes, if they agree to these things, I believe I would support their ETC status.
So I think that really, quite honestly, closes up this work session. But, I mean, as far as the point we're trying to get to, but then the second question, though, is the big one about the what if, I think. Because now, to go through the memorandum, the way when I read through this was basically, and Austin, I know you helped write it up, and I mean, do you want to walk through it real quickly? You probably could do a better job. Why don't you just take a couple minutes and walk through it instead of me trying to say what I think you told me. But don't give me a 30-minute deal. Give me the 5-minute version.
Okay. I think really a lot of the analysis is kind of just the basics that most people, if you're in this work session, probably already know what we have to do for ETC designation and the FCC rulings and everything like that. But what really would be important would be at the very end, the summarizing. We did find a case that we had gotten to dealing with SB 2320 from the early 90s, where basically if the PSC wanted to impose some regulations, and the PSC at that time were acting a little bit proactively. They were acting before a company or before someone had brought in a complaint. They were working on their own based on the new laws. And the court held that the PSC can do that. They can move forward without a complaint, and they can hold hearings and make up and find new rules and find new holdings as long as they then go through the proper channels afterwards. Once they have found what they want their new rule to be, they have to actually go through the proper rulemaking process of holding an additional hearings and saying, here's our new proposed rules. Let the companies have their input at the hearings, rather than just saying, here are the rules. We're going to start implementing them right away.
Okay, so in a nutshell, if we had something in our rules now that said that in order for someone to get this status, they had to sign these certification, it'd be a layup. They would have to do it because it's in our rules package. But since it's not in our rules package, it's strictly voluntary for the companies right now.
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
If we wanted to put that into the rules, we'd have to say that these are our proposed rules and hold a hearing just on the hearings on the rules and everything, go through the channels for the rulemaking process.
Okay.
But we could be operating as though they were rules during the time that the rulemaking process is going on?
Only if they are willing. Only if they willingly offer to do that, the company. We're not operating as though we're rules because we couldn't enforce or, sue for a violation or whatever.
It's voluntary up until the point when there are official rules.
But if you play it out, let's just the hypothetical. Let's say we go through and we've made it clear that if Telluride doesn't have anything that comes out in this first page, and they are willing to sign the certification, that we're going to vote for it. But if they come back and they're not willing to sign it, and we then deny it, then it's up to them to appeal it. And based on what the current law read is, they would have grounds to appeal it until we have a rules package in place.
Right. I don't want to overstate, though, because I haven't done this part. We could probably go down that certification, and there's probably some things in their annual reports being one, that maybe we already require. There's probably some items in there that are already under our rules. I'd have to look item by item. But for anything that wouldn't be covered under current rules, what you just said is true.
Okay. But then we could also go the other way around. Let's say people are here. They're gearing directly what we're saying. So the company comes back and they agree to everything except for one of the conditions. Then we'd probably have to have another work session to see how hard and fast we felt about that one condition until it gets into a rules package. That's the way I would follow that, I guess.
What's the timing of us creating the rules?
It goes Lana will always have to clean up here a little bit, but we'll have a rules package that we'll put in. The Attorney General will walk through it and make sure it's all good to go. Then it'll go to Legislative Council and eventually get blessed by the legislature. The timing, it takes us at least a year to get a rules package through. So we're working on one right now, quite honestly, for the next session, because Jim always has some rules upstairs, and we no doubt usually have something with pipeline safety that we have to tweak a little bit. So it's usually every legislative cycle we submit a rules package. And that doesn't mean we couldn't do it out of cycle, I guess, but that's normally the way we follow, and it seems to work well.
The thing that I thought was really interesting about the old case that Austin found was that we had opened an it was about ordering equal access. And U.S. West appealed us, and the independent incumbents appealed, or the co-ops appealed us. They're both mad after this huge investigation and 7 days of hearings or something like that. So we weren't operating without information. We had tons of information, a big long order, which we can now get electronically, thanks to Austin. But what the court said is, now you know all this stuff, and you know you want to do something that's good for the public interest. This is how you do it. And I thought that it really brought it back to that's the point. And then all the things the companies were appealing over and all the reasons they thought it was terrible was what would come out at a rulemaking hearing. And you'd get to weigh it in deciding whether to do it or not.
And much of this has become settled law in some of that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, quite honestly, Randy, I think that some of this is the frustration that we're having at the state level because we've lost so much jurisdiction on telecom. We're asked to try to protect North Dakota customers when they've taken away all of our authority to do so. They being the FCC and others. And so that's where the rules package comes in, I guess, that would really solidify some of our rights. And then there'd be a question during all the hearings. So, but I guess I'm fine with we could give the company the opportunity. If they sign it and move on and everything's good, we're out of this clean and we submit a rules package if we like. If the company does not want to do it, then we cross that bridge and we come to it.
And I'm comfortable with that, and I would hope that the prospective carriers would be comfortable with it too, because at the end of the day, a lot of what I've read goes back to what's in the public interest, And it seems to me, you know, when you have a program that's set up for people that have certain qualifications, making sure that, that in fact, those are the people getting services from the program is in the public interest of doing things right. And so I don't think that this is in any way violating the spirit of what our authority ought to be. And so I'm comfortable with this. And okay. Like I say, barring finding something in the information with Telluride's application.
No, I appreciate that thought, Commissioner. I will maybe expound upon what you said, though, is that if a commissioner just take the certification, all this aside, if you just said, I don't think this is in the public interest, I think that'd be a whole different argument. If you can give me your legal analysis there, but if two commissioners said, all this other stuff aside, we just don't think it's good for North Dakota's public interest to let all these carriers come in, that would be a whole different argument as it went forward in an appeal. So we kind of walked down the road of certification, I think, that we're trying to get more protection built in. But if we just didn't do that and just said, nope, I don't like this because there's too many carriers fighting over too few people, there's not enough rules in place, I don't like it. I mean, that...
It's still open to appeal, but it is a different basis. It's an abuse of discretion, rational basis for concluding that kind of thing.
And then you'd have to have something in the record that said why you did that, and that would be back to, I think we've clearly established there's concerns about it. But that, I mean, that's a whole other way to look at these. Because that was one of the things when I first looked at these cases is trying to figure out how it was in the public interest. And that's when I went back to the FCC has taken away so much state jurisdiction that you kind of get to the point where you're just more of checking the high spots and then seeing how it all plays out. But if let's say this database doesn't come through like they're planning, I think that's where I'm putting a lot of credibility, hopefully, in this database of duplication of services. If this never comes offline, you know, I would like to look at all these again and maybe, do they come up for renewal? They don't, do they? They just get it or they don't get it. But if this database doesn't pan out, maybe we go back and ask to revoke some of these.
I think the purpose of the annual filing is so that you would have a clue if you thought somebody did not deserve it any longer. ETC, is that true, Pat? The purpose of annual filing?
The ETC.
Yeah, it's not a renewal, but...
You can jab this one, Pat.
The ETC annual filing, if you're thinking of the financial filing, it has to do with determining whether, or it's a record to show whether the companies are spending the money in for the purposes that the federal funding was intended.
Right. I mean, I'm not laying things out too far in advance, but I think in my mind, Randy, Commissioner, that I guess I think that we follow what we're doing is we offer the company the chance to sign these certifications and do those things. If they come back and they're unwilling to do that, I will open up the whole public interest argument a little bit deeper. That if you've got a company not willing to sign these things, that just which are basically not that big a deal,
right.
If you've got a company that's not willing to do that, I'll want to know more about why they won't want to do it, and that maybe drive me to a not in the public interest statement.
And I think that was sort of the purpose of the letter, too, I believe. I mean, one was to see if they're willing to do it, but one was to see if there's anything else we should know about them that would cause a public interest concern.
Right.
Right? And to put in the record.
Okay.
So.
All right.
You know, we got so caught up in this new information and the waste, fraud, and abuse thing. I did have one other question. I almost forgot. Luckily, I had tabbed it here because kind of forgot about the initial application. In the initial letter from the Jonas Walker firm, number 18, about 10 or 11 pages in, they point out that they would pay 911 fees to the local authorities. And is that something that we ought to... you know, hold out is something that we're going to expect of all Lifeline providers? I don't know, maybe they have to by federal law. I'm not sure about that. And then, but it led me to wondering all the other things that are on a regular phone bill, do some of these Lifeline-only providers pay the 911 fees and some don't? Do some of them pay any other taxes? Is there state and local tax on these, like we have with a regular landline telephone? And although it's only 4 cents, but we just worked on it a month or so, our telecom relay service fee, do they get charged that?
I have no idea. I mean, whatever any similarly situated company is charged, they should be charged by those other entities, tax or counties or whoever it is. Do you know, Pat?
I'm just thinking real quick. Rather than thinking of, well, there's two ways, I think. But it's a Lifeline, even though it's a Lifeline service, it is still a wireless local exchange service access to telecommunications network. And in that respect, is this just like any other wireless access?
Someone has entered the conference.
To the network. However,
Hey, Julie, is that you?
It is.
Okay, we're just going around and around here. I'll give you the summary once we kind of get done from where we're at, and we can see if you have any.
Sounds good.
But I think that I do not think that these customers, the Lifeline-only customers.
If Patrick can talk more into the mic, that would be great. I can't quite hear him.
Okay. Is that better?
Yep, that's better.
I do not believe the Lifeline-only customer, Lifeline customers are paying for the 911. That charge the counties, collect for 911.
Well, it says in this application that Telrite intends to.
They intend to.
But of course, that's outside our jurisdiction.
It is.
We have a court case that says that too. Yeah. So whatever they're going to do, they have to do and comply with somebody else's rules, not ours. I mean, either way.
The same is true of you. I can't really hear Alana.
I'm sorry. I don't have a voice. Whether or not they pay the 911 fee is probably interesting, but I don't think we have any authority to worry about it. Because we do have a case that says it's non-jurisdictional to the PSC. It's the local authority jurisdiction, local taxing. If it hasn't changed over the last however many years, it is local taxing jurisdiction. However it's implemented, I don't know.
And what about that telecom relay thing? Do we have some authority over that, or did we just sign off on that report?
Not over how it's assessed. We have how much it is, but not how it's assessed. There's another law someplace that explains that, but not in our authority.
Okay, Julie, kind of what I guess what we've done is we started out the work session, and the Sarah had provided that document with the six questions up front, kind of reviewed those and didn't have any additions to it. Then the second document of the certification with the 18 different, Commissioner Christman had some questions on number 17. We're going to add a form in there. But basically, the certification looks pretty good from where the two of us were at. And then Austin and Alana prepared a memo basically kind of outlining a little bit of the legal background to where with the current commission actually has the authority to make them sign this certification. And the way it is right now, based on a previous case, is that since we have nothing in our rules package that says we can make a company sign this, it's strictly voluntary. So we'll have to look at if we want this to happen all the time where we can make a company do it, then we put that in the rules package. But then I caveat on that a little bit that we still go back to that these cases, are they yes or no in the public interest? And my thought was these forms that Commissioner Crispin and Sarah put together is pretty good, and if you've got a company that is not willing to sign it in lieu of our rules being done, that would open up the whole, is it in the public interest or not? So I think right now both Randy and I are kind of comfortable with where we're at and be happy to hear any of your thoughts about what I just said, and that might wrap up the work session actually.
Yeah, there's nothing in those forms that I think would be so onerous for the company that they should have a big problem with signing them. Not that I could see, anyway. So I would hope that they would go along with it. And my other kind of overriding thought is it feels to me like this form and the certification is kind of a intermediary step here. A lot of this, it feels to me, is going to be fixed with the creation of the federal system, the database that's going to be more of a foolproof way of identifying the fraud. So I think it's great that we can take these steps until that system is in place. Who knows, maybe it'll be delayed. And then at that point, some of those additional federal tools will kick in that will help address this whole issue of fraud that we're trying to address in some of our measures.
Okay, that sounds so. You would be generally supportive of moving forward with the rules package on this, and then we'll, as that process unfolds, there'll be potential chances for hearings. So you don't have any major concerns with where we're at right now?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Then I think that what my plan would be, if it's okay with the two of you, is that we turn it back over to Sarah, and as soon as she comes and tells us what the company's next move is, if they can get all this put together and if the company agrees to sign everything, it could be on our next agenda item, our next meeting for voting. If the company doesn't agree to everything, then we'll schedule a work session the next meeting, and we'll proceed from there if that's okay with Randy and you.
Sounds good. The one question I have is on the list of questions that we're asking the company, at what point do they get those questions? We kind of went through them with Nexus in our hearing last week. Is that our plan moving forward, that these are things we're going to ask them in the hearing, or when do they get those questions and are responsible for getting us that information?
I can answer that. Julie, I guess I would look at it kind of like we do in the certification in our like pipeline hearings. Pat has them sign the certification before the hearing or right afterwards, but oftentimes we still duplicate to those questions in the hearing because we want additional details. So Sarah maybe want to chime in too, but I think that we would have the company sign this. You know, as soon as they express a desire to request this, we'd say, okay, here's a certification. It would make it a lot easier for you as you go into the hearing. And then it doesn't mean we wouldn't ask those same questions. Sarah, do you see it?
There's the certification document plus that list of six or seven questions.
That, right? I think, would all need to be before the hearing, because we might still ask those questions in more detail in the hearing, but it'd be helpful to have those answers back before the hearing so we can at least see their responses and then maybe amplify some of our questions.
So I guess from Sarah, Patrick, how do you see that list of questions fitting in with all this? Are you going to send it to them after we receive their application, or how do you see those functioning?
I could go ahead.
I guess I see that. I see the commission asking the questions at an informal hearing or a formal hearing, whichever the process leads to, but we can certainly provide the questions to them before that time, and if they want to answer them ahead of time, they can do that. But at the very least, they would be answered at the hearing.
Okay.
Whether
so
informal
sort of
or
like
formal.
We did with Nexus, because that's kind of how we handle it with them, it seems to me.
Sure.
The question document is really relevant only to this pending case because it came up in the middle.
Right.
I mean, it will either be part of what we expect in an application or part of the certification that we staff discusses with them, you know, and at an informal. But in this case, we need to send the letter and then also the certification.
To tell right.
Right. Excuse me.
Well, I guess my recommendation, seeing that most of these have been going forward as an opportunity for hearing and not an actual hearing, that if we get an application or for all the applications that are pending right now, I guess I don't understand why we wouldn't want to just send them this information, because we may not need to have informal or formal hearings if we have all the information already.
I think Sarah's right on that, and also if there's some question about it, if they have a concern on one thing, or the answer is no, and they want to have a hearing about it. You know, a lot of these companies are from all over the country, and so they send someone here to represent them. And if they haven't seen the questions in advance, they might not be very positive of what the company's answer is. So I do think it is important that they know not every question we might think of in a hearing, but the general ones that we for sure want answers to.
Okay, so as soon as Sarah or Pat knows about it, we'll get them the questions, and then we'll see what the responses are. Okay. All right. Julie, anything else?
That's it for me.
Okay. Commissioner Christman, Randy?
Nothing more for me. Thank you for everybody's time on this, and actually the patience of the companies, too, because as we get into these, you know, hopefully future ones might go even faster and smoother, but as we start something new, you know, your questions are for the first time, and so hopefully in the future this process goes more quickly.
Okay, thank you, Randy. All right, with that, we'll close the work session on case number PU 13-61, and then what we'll do is we'll, as soon as Scott stops this tape, we'll start the next work session. So thank you all very much.
Hey, Randy, if you can talk into your mic more.